Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. For some time now, we have been studying the web of debt, which is essentially the shocking truth about our money system and how we can break free from it. Over the last several months, I've been looking at how our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been, in fact, privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing us of the value of our money. The web of debt really is a thesis that unravels the deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are all heading. But it also explores a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. What we're looking at is to find financial security, our own and our nation's and the world's, and that's what we have been dedicating this show to over the last several months in a series exploring the book, The Web of Debt. The Web of Debt is a phenomenal work written by Ellen Hodgson Brown. And I have to say at the beginning that the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles related to debt. I highly recommend the book, The Web of Debt, and her website by the same name. And you can also review all of the shows in this series at the archives, www.kruufm.com, under Life and Debt. Specifically, Life and Debt Web are the shows that are related to this book. So recently what we've been talking about is central banking. Today we have the Fed, but back at the beginning of the country, there was a central bank, which some of the founding fathers opposed greatly, like Jefferson. The reason is that it's a private institution, and it's owned by private powers, oftentimes foreign private powers. In effect, this central banking institution runs the finances of the entire nation, contrary to what most people think, that in fact the government is running the finances. It's not the government's money. We chose for that to occur and are suffering as a result. Back at the point for the first charter for a national bank, it ran its course, and then while he was president, Thomas Jefferson was instrumental in Congress's refusal to renew the charter of the first U.S. bank in 1811. When the first U.S. bank was liquidated, Thomas Jefferson's great fears and suspicions were confirmed. 18,000 of the bank's 25,000 shares were owned by foreigners, mostly English and Dutch. The foreign domination the revolution had been fought to eliminate had crept back in through the country's private banking system. Congressman Dacia of Kentucky, speaking in the House of Representatives, declared that this accumulation of foreign capital was one of the engines for overturning civil liberty, and that he had no doubt King George III was the principal stockholder. When Congress later renewed the bank's charter, Andrew Jackson vetoed it. He too expressed concern that a major portion of the bank's shareholders were foreigners. He said in his veto bill, "Is there no danger to our liberty and independence in a bank that in its nature has so little to bind it to our country? Of the course which would be pursued by a bank almost wholly owned by the subjects of a foreign power, there can be no doubt. Controlling our currency, receiving our public monies, and holding thousands of our citizens in dependence, it would be more formidable and dangerous than a naval and military power of the enemy." This, of course, is true. However, the curious point is that, in fact, it wasn't foreign nations really that owned the bank. It was private individuals who were foreigners, who in many cases could care less about their countries. They were only interested in the financial profiteering from owning such interests. So who were these subjects of a foreign power who owned the bank? In the History of the Great American Fortunes, published in 1936, Gustavus Myers pointed to the formidable British banking dynasty, the House of Rothschild. Myers wrote, "Under the surface, the Rothschilds long had a powerful influence in dictating American financial laws. The law records show that they were the power in the old bank of the United States." Like the German Hanoverian kings, the Rothschilds' banking empire was British only in the sense that it had been in England for a long time. As we mentioned before, its roots were actually in Germany. The House of Rothschilds was founded in Frankfurt in the mid-18th century when a moneylender named Mael Amschel Bauer changed his name to Amschel Rothschild and fathered 10 children. His 5 sons were sent to the major capitals of Europe to open branches of the family banking business. Nathan, the most astute of these sons, went to London where he opened the family branch called N.M. Rothschilds and Sons. Nathan's brothers managed N.M. Rothschilds branches in Paris, Vienna, Berlin, and Naples. The family fortunes got a major boost in 1815 when Nathan pulled off the mother of all insider trades. He led British investors to believe that the Duke of Wellington had lost to Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo. In a matter of hours, British government bond prices plummeted. Nathan, who had advanced information, then swiftly bought up the entire market in government bonds, acquiring a dominant holding in England's debt for pennies on the pound. Over the course of the 19th century, N.M. Rothschild would become the biggest bank in the world, and the 5 brothers would come to control most of the foreign loan business of Europe. "Let me issue and control a nation's money," Amschel Rothschild is said to have boasted in 1790, "and I care not who writes its laws." If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So this is the rub in all of the private banking, central banking issues. Whatever person or institution, that is the international banking cartel today, can issue and control a nation's money, it really doesn't matter who writes the laws. This is precisely the same thing that exists in the United States with the Federal Reserve and its connection to the international banking cartel. Another interesting point in what we just discussed was how inside information and agendas, like knowing that the Duke of Wellington had actually beaten Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo, but it was suggested and acted upon that he had lost, thereby allowing the Rothschilds to buy up all of the stock on the British bond market, is nothing different than happens today at the highest levels of the banking system. In addition, when a banking power like that can speculate in markets, it can, and as we will see, actually is able to destroy economies of entire nations. When in 1811, Thomas Jefferson was able to get a block in the renewal process of the first U.S. bank's charter, Nathan Rothschild already possessed substantial political clout in England and was lending money to the U.S. government and certain states. He's reported to have threatened that either the application for renewal of the charter is granted or the United States will find itself in a most disastrous war. The charter was not granted, and the United States did find itself in another war with England, the War of 1812. War again led to inflationary and heavy government debt. So once again, we're seeing an example of how the government, and of course all of the people, suffer because the government is not producing its own money. It's borrowing money from a private institution. So during that war, the inflation and debt that resulted and the inability to collect taxes resulted in some reasons for chartering the Second Bank of the United States as a private national bank. So Rothschild had won. The 20-year charter was signed by President James Madison in 1816. It authorized the bank and its branches to issue the nation's money in the form of banknotes, again shifting the power to create the national money supply into private hands. And the disaster lives on. Now let's go back a little bit further. Jefferson was out of town when the Constitution was drafted, serving as America's minister to France during the dramatic period leading up to the French Revolution. But even if he had been there, he would probably have gone along with the majority and voted to omit paper money from the Constitution. After watching the national debt mushroom, he wrote to John Taylor in 1798, "I wish it were possible to obtain a single amendment to our Constitution, taking from the federal government the power to borrow money. I now deny their power of making paper money or anything else a legal tender." It actually took several decades before Thomas Jefferson realized that the villain was not paper money itself. It was private debt masquerading as paper money, a private debt owed to bankers who were merely pretending to have money. Jefferson wrote to Treasury Secretary Gallatin in 1815, "The Treasury, lacking confidence in the country, delivered itself bound hand and foot to bold and bankrupt adventurers and bankers pretending to have money, whom it could have crushed at any moment." He later wrote to John Taylor in 1816, "I sincerely believe with you that banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies, and that the principle of spending money to be paid by posterity under the name of funding is but swindling futurity on a large scale." He had earlier said, "Although we have so foolishly allowed the field of circulating medium to be filched from us by private individuals, I think we may recover it. The states should be asked to transfer the right of issuing paper money to Congress in perpetuity." He said, "The nation may continue to issue its bills," that's paper notes, "as far as it needs require and the limits of circulation allow. Those limits are understood at present to be $200 millions. In 1803, Jefferson said of private national bank, "This institution is one of the most deadly hostility against the principles of our Constitution. Suppose a series of emergencies should occur. An institution like this, in a critical moment, might overthrow the government. He asked, could we start toward independently using our own money to form our own bank? The Constitution gave Congress the power only to coin money, but Jefferson argued that constitutions could be amended. In 1816, he wrote, some men look at constitutions with sanctimonious reverence and deem them, like the Ark of the Covenant, too sacred to be touched. They ascribe to the men of the preceding age a wisdom more than human, and suppose what they did to be beyond amendment. Law and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. As that becomes more developed, more enlightened, as new discoveries are made, institutions must also advance to keep pace with the times. We might as well require a man to wear still the coat which fitted him when a boy, as civilized society to remain forever under the regimen of their barbarous ancestors. During the congressional debate over a second U.S. bank, Senator John Calhoun proposed a plan for a truly national bank along the lines suggested by Jefferson. A wholly government-owned national bank could issue the nation's own credit directly without having to borrow from a private bank that issued it. The plan was later endorsed by Senator Henry Clay, but it would be several more decades before the Civil War would provide the pretext for Abraham Lincoln to authorize Congress to issue its own money. The second U.S. bank chartered in 1816 was 80% privately owned. Now let's move forward a little bit to Andrew Jackson, who is another person totally against the concept of a private national bank. Andrew Jackson was a hero of the War of 1812 with enormous popular appeal. He was the first of the unlettered scarecrows to reach the White House, to be followed by the even mightier Abraham Lincoln, another unlettered president. Jackson did receive an honorary degree from Harvard College in 1833, but it was over the objection of Harvard alumnus John Quincy Adams, who called him a barbarian who could not write a sentence of grammar and hardly could spell his own name. Perhaps, but Old Hickory truly believed in the will of the Democratic majority, and he spoke to the common people in a way they could understand. After the Federalists ceased to be a major national party, the Democratic Republicans dominated the political scene for a long time, and they did this alone. In 1824, four candidates ran for president as Democratic Republicans from different states: Andrew Jackson, John Quincy Adams, William Crawford, and Henry Clay. Jackson easily won the popular vote, but he did not have enough electoral votes to win the presidency, so the matter went to the House of Representatives, where Clay threw his support to Adams, who won. But popular sentiment remained with Jackson, who won by a wide margin against Adams in the election of 1828. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Andrew Jackson believed in a strong presidency and a strong union. He stood up to the bankers on the matter of the bank, which he viewed as operating mainly for the upper classes at the expense of the working people. In 1829, he warned, the bold efforts the present bank has made to control the government are but premonitions of the fate that awaits the American people should they be deluded into a perpetuation of this institution or the establishment of another like it. Whether Congress itself had the right to issue paper money, Jackson said, was not clear, but if Congress had the right under the Constitution to issue paper money, it was given them to be used by themselves, not to be delegated to individuals or corporations. His grim premonitions about the bank appear to be confirmed when mismanagement under its first president led to financial disaster, depression, bankruptcies, and unemployment. But the bank began to flourish under its second president, Nicholas Biddle, who petitioned Congress for a renewal of its charter in 1832. Jackson, who was then up for re-election, expressed his views to the SBID in no uncertain terms. He called the bank a hydra-headed monster eating the flesh of the common man. He swore to do battle with the monster and to slay it or be slain by it. In a speech that could have been given today, he said of the bank, "I have had men watching you for a long time and am convinced that you have used the funds of the bank to speculate in the breadstuffs of the country. When you won, you divided the profits amongst you, and when you lost, you charged it to the bank. You tell me that if I take the deposits from the bank and annul its charter, I shall ruin 10,000 families. That may be true, gentlemen, but that is your sin. Should I let you go on, you will ruin 50,000 families, and that would be my sin. You are a den of vipers and thieves. I have determined to rout you out, and by the eternal, I will rout you out." In the 1832 election, Jackson ran on the Democratic Party ticket against Henry Clay, whose party was now called the National Republican Party. Its members considered themselves nationalists because they saw the country as a nation rather than a loose confederation of states, and because they promoted strong nation-building measures such as the construction of interstate roads. Clay advocated a strong protectionist platform that kept productivity and financing within the country, allowing it to grow up in its own backyard, free from economic attack from abroad. It was Clay who first called this approach the American system to distinguish it from the British system of free trade. The British system was supported by Jackson and opposed by Clay, who thought it would open the country to exploitation by foreign financiers and industrialists. To prevent that, Clay advocated a tariff favoring domestic industry, congressionally financed national improvements, and a national bank. More than $3 million were poured into Clay's campaign, then an enormous sum. But Jackson won by a landslide. He had the vote of the people, but not of Congress, which proceeded to pass the Bank Renewal Bill. Jackson promptly vetoed it, and in a show of his self-taught eloquence, he said in his veto bill, "There are no necessary evils in government. Its evils exist only in its abuses. If it would confine itself to equal protection, and as heaven does its rains, shower its favors alike on the high and the low, the rich and the poor, it would be an unqualified blessing. In the act before me, there seems to be a wide and unnecessary departure from these just principles. Many of our rich men have not been content with equal protection and equal benefits, but have besought us to make them richer by act of Congress. If we cannot at once, in justice to interests vested under improvident legislation, make our government what it ought to be, we can at least take a stand against all new grants of monopolies and exclusive privileges, against any prostitution of our government to the advancement of the few at the expense of the many." Jackson succeeded in vetoing the bill, but he knew that his battle with the bank was just beginning. The hydra of corruption is only scotched, not dead, he exclaimed. Boldly taking the hydra by the horns, he ordered the new Treasury Secretary to start transferring the government's deposits from the second U.S. bank into state banks. When the secretary refused, Jackson fired him and appointed another. When that secretary refused, Jackson appointed a third. When the third secretary proceeded to do as he was told, Jackson was triumphant. "I have it chained," he said of the banking monster. I am ready with screws to draw every tooth and then the stumps. But Biddle and his bank were indeed only scotched, not dead. Biddle used his influence to get the Senate to reject the new secretary's nomination. Then he threatened to cause a national depression if the bank were not rechartered. Biddle openly declared, "Nothing but widespread suffering will produce an effect on Congress. Our only safety is in pursuing a steady course of firm monetary restriction, and I have no doubt that such a course will ultimately lead to restoration of the currency and the recharter of the bank." Biddle proceeded to make good on his threat by sharply contracting the money supply. Old loans were called in and new ones were refused. A financial panic ensued, followed by a deep economic depression. Biddle blamed it all on Jackson, and the newspapers picked up the charge. Jackson was officially censured by a Senate resolution. The tide turned, however, when the governor of Pennsylvania, where the bank was located, came out in support of the president and strongly critical of the bank. And Biddle was caught boasting in public about the bank's plan to crash the economy. In April 1834, the House of Representatives voted 134-82 against rechartering the bank, and a special committee was established to investigate whether it had caused the crash. In January of 1835, in what may have been his finest hour, Jackson paid off the final installment on the national debt. No national debt. He had succeeded in doing something that had never been done before and, unfortunately, has not been done since. He reduced the national debt to zero and accumulated a surplus. The following year, the charter for the Second Bank of the United States expired, and Biddle was arrested and charged with fraud. He was tried and acquitted, but he died while tied up in civil suits. As we just recently learned, none of these fraud or inside job kind of allegations have been dealt with in the current economy against the masterminds of the Wall Street horrors. Watching the movie Inside Job will show us the inside story. Well, Andrew Jackson had beaten the bank. His personal secretary, Nicholas Trist, called it the crowning glory of AJ's life and the most important service he has ever rendered his country. The Boston Post compared it to Jesus throwing the money changers out of the temple. But Jackson, like Jesus, found that taking on the money changers was risky business. "The bank is trying to kill me," he said, "but I will kill it." He was the victim of an assassination attempt, but both the assassin's shots missed. Abraham Lincoln would not be so lucky. So I'd just like to leave with a repeat of this really unbelievable point that Jackson had paid the final installment on the national debt, which really was his finest hour. He had succeeded in doing something which was never done before and has not been done since, reducing the national debt to zero and accumulating a surplus. And just by way of contrast, when President Clinton balanced the budget in 2000, that did not include paying off the national debt, which had stood at $5 trillion. It's amazing what you can do when you play with numbers. Such is the way of politics. And next show, we will move on to Abraham Lincoln, the scarecrow with a brain. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt manageable life.